see it. I can see it right now. If I was going to be around you all very much, I'd have to get an acoustic saxophone. I'd have to find one made out of wood. Something made out of wood. Because I repeat from last year, you just can't hardly put brass with grass. You just can't hardly do it. I'd have to have a wood one. And, you know, I really appreciated the service all day today. I appreciated Brother Ronnie Wheeler standing up here before us, preaching to us. And when he didn't feel like it, you think it's the first time that he's ever done that? Or do you think it's the first time any preacher that you've ever had come by this church ever stood up in this pulpit and preached when they really didn't feel like it? Sometimes we don't have the luxury that some folks have. Sometimes, you know, that's why we go to the hospital sometimes, just get away from it all. I saw an ambulance go by right then with its lights flashing. I said, "You just hang on, I'll be there in just a second. Just pull in, I'll walk up there to you." But I really appreciate ministers, and I appreciate Brother Barnett. Pastor's there close to us, and you know, it probably wouldn't look right if I left my services and went down there just hearing preach. Some of my folks probably wouldn't understand. And, of course, if some of his folks went up to my, you know, and what I can't figure out is why me and him ain't smart enough. Now, I already told you he don't think normal. Why ain't me and him smart enough to figure out how to listen to each other preach somewhere other than Virginia? I mean, Missouri, you know, there's a lot of closer places than this. But here we are. And he opened for us a gate today and made it more vivid. I mean, made it more vivid in my mind than it ever was. I usually, especially when I was evangelizing, my wife, she would diligently scribble down my text or the title of my message. We kind of did that in those earlier days of evangelizing, especially. Couldn't remember where I was at, where I'd gone, what I'd done. And last year, you want to hear what I preached last year? I'll tell you. God, I had him tell me what it was last year. She wasn't here. I didn't write nothing down. I preached on Monday night, "Only Luke is with me." Then I preached on Tuesday night, "Ask for help." Wednesday night, I preached on interruption. Thursday night, "That we may have life." And Friday night, "What's holding you back?" I ain't got the slightest idea. I mean, I tell you, if I had to go back right now and rummage through my files, I hardly ever titled things the same. There at home here lately, I haven't known what to call them. Actually, I just let my deacon title them. And then I ain't got the nerve to look. But for 36, is that right, 36 years? I've been doing this 37 years, 36 years. I'm 56. I know I don't look it. I'm 56 years old, and I was at one campground, and I'll just tell you that I was at one campground, not here, but somebody has mentioned it here, kind of joking. But I was at one campground way down south, or way down, I don't even remember where it was at, but a long way away. And I walked by, I remember now, I walked by some ladies. And they didn't know I was as close as I was to them. And one of them looked over at the other and said, "Isn't he old? Doesn't he look wrinkled? Have you noticed when he gets up there behind, you know?" And I knew he was talking about me. Randy wasn't preaching that meeting. He said, "Don't he look old?" And then they came out with the killer. Then they came out with the killer line. And they said, but doesn't his young wife look young? And I stopped and threw it in reverse because I just couldn't stand it. And I said, excuse me. Yes. I said, she's older than I am. But she doesn't look it. She acts it, but she doesn't look it. That's older by about a month, you know. But it's the sweetest month I can think of during a year, that one little gap right through there. But through those years, after that, the Lord dealt with me about entering into the ministry. Out of those 56 years, 36 of them has been stepping up behind pulpits and preaching revivals before I was married, and then after I was married, and my wife working on my character and my disposition in positive ways. I, by nature, am a person. I ain't going to preach long. I don't even know what. I kind of feel. Terry Bolin got up the other night at our meeting and said he kind of felt like a mosquito on a fat man. He knew what to do. He just didn't know where to start. That's kind of how I feel tonight. But my wife has been such a, she has been such a backbone, sitting back sometimes and unbeknownst to the congregation, that they're one of the main reasons I even started going to camp meetings. She made me. She told me, you need to go. You need to go. I was just as happy sulking off to the travel trailer of a night after revival, get out of the crowd, not be around. I was fairly well content to harbor myself within myself, and she has been instrumental in forcing me against my nature to develop my character. And a wife will do that for you, fellas, if you'll let them and listen to them and not be offended by it. Yeah. Boy, I tell you, I wish James Dobson was here tonight. I'd let him focus on the family and I'd go have a hot dog. But he ain't. So I want to talk to you about something tonight. I'd brush through two or three things, and it always amazed me. I'd watch at brother at camp meetings as brother Addis and brother Don Rich and them guys would come walking in, and they'd lay their Bible down, and they wouldn't pick it up again through the whole service until it was time to preach, and they walked up there with the mind of God ready to blow the back wall out with whatever they were fixing to preach. But in later years, I noticed Brother Rich at our camp meeting especially, sitting back kind of thumbing through the pages. And he told me one night that, it's a different day and it's a different age now. And there are so many spirits. You have to feel. You have to feel for the right spirit. You have to reach for it. You got to make sure you're on target. And my target tonight was going to be found over in the New Testament. And I was going to talk to you about a need of the hour. But something in me, I mean, we will have that same need tomorrow night. And so what I want to talk to you about tonight is found in 1 Kings chapter number 2. In 1 Kings chapter number 2, and really, I've got things to preach about. You're not in this for 36 years and not have topics and titles and victories and horror stories and all the rest of the things that goes along with it. I've had some momentous times in my life. Put on a new pair of shoes. Stepped into a Pentecostal holiness church down in Tennessee. Turned the pulpit over to me. And on the way up there, feet flew out from underneath me and landed flat on my back. That was a spiritual moment there in my life. Traveled with Terry Bolden for 6 months, which was another traumatic experience in my life. We were doing our laundry one day in a laundromat. He told me to watch the clothes while he went next door for something. I watched them. I watched them. They were in that big old tumble dryer, and I watched them. And then I watched us as we had to go buy some more. You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised what a good hot dryer would do to clothes. Okay, wonderful. Those wonderful memories like that. I heard Brother Suits. I wish Brother Suits wouldn't tell everything he knows. I heard Brother Suits tell Brother Webb, and I wished he hadn't have told Brother Webb. If he could have told anybody else. This was one of those little moment things that I really hadn't shared with the world. But Brother Suits told Brother Webb. There was a funeral service up in Kentucky. I'd been to a funeral service, drove all the way about 5 or 5.5 hours to be at the funeral service. I came in for the visitation because the preacher there was a friend of mine that I'd preached for before. And that night his wife asked me if I'd play the piano, that she didn't have a piano player, and I gladly told her I'll do what I can. And we got to the funeral home, and it was one of them laid-out funeral homes where the music was off in some other room with little speakers. You couldn't see or hear anything. And so I went off in that room and started playing. And the big wig come by and he said, "We got two lights here, a green light and a red light. When you're finished, we hit the green light and you can come out. As long as the red light is on, you keep playing." So I played, and it was time to march around the casket, and I was playing. And I was playing, and you know, I was already saying, I said, "Boy, he has got a crowd at this funeral. I mean," and I was playing, and I'd already gone through precious memories, and when they rang them golden bells, and I was starting to try to find something that had something to do with firecrackers. I mean, my back was a-hurting, my legs was a-hurting. I was starting to just kept sitting there, and that light was not changing. And I guess it was an hour, or an hour and 15 minutes. A guy come walking by, about an hour and a half. A guy come walking through with a vacuum cleaner. I looked at him, he said, "I'm enjoying the music, but you can quit now." And I said, "What about the funeral?" He said, "They've been going to the cemetery for 45, 50 minutes. Precious memories. Okay. Now, I walked outside and called my wife, and I said, "You ain't going to believe this. You ain't going to believe it. The funeral has pulled off and left me." So I drove back home, and I just hate that Brother Suit said anything about it, but there it goes. I'm in 1 Kings. I got a serious, to me it is, in 1 Kings chapter number 2, it is serious to me, especially when you read the fact that David, the hero of the Old Testament, that everybody rallies around until those moments of his failures, and then we're quick to pick him right back up. In that verse, in that chapter, he's fixing to pass off the scene, and his boy is fixing to take over. And I can go on down through some of that, but I'm going to go to my one verse, and I want to read you verse 28, 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 28. Simply because I can't get away from this, and simply because it just feels like this is the right thing that I should make mention of tonight to this particular congregation. 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 28. "Then tidings came to Joab." For Joab had turned after Adonijah. though he turned not after Absalom. And Joab fled into the tabernacle of the Lord, and he called hold on the horns of the altar. I guess the first time that my eyes drifted across that, I probably didn't notice it any more than maybe you did when your eyes drifted across it. In fact, it was a little bit hard for me, I guess, to even comprehend what was being said, because sometimes the Bible says things in such different ways. Joab had turned after Adonijah, though he turned not after Absalom. And I noticed that the longer that I applied myself, and the longer that I tried to study about that, because sometimes verses leap out at me, and I know they are put there for me to deal with and to work with. That's what preaching is all about. And in just a few little sentences that I read to you tonight, and this won't be long, but in the first few little sentences that I read to you tonight, or spoke to you about David, or spoke to you about Solomon, I have read to you the tragic end of a very strong man, a very strong leader. In that verse right there, it could have summed up the entire life of Joab when you know the whole story, front to back and side to side. And I guess the most tragic thing about this job that I have, and the friends that I run with, and the people that I love, and the churches that I hold dear to my heart, and I told Brother Barnett coming in earlier tonight, I said, why do we do this? Why do we get? I mean, he's sick, stomachs are bothering him, and I'm in a constant nervous breakdown stupor when I'm in these meetings. Why do we do this? Why don't we learn how to say no when some folks calls us? And the answer is, it's about you, and it's about the call of God, and it's about a burning desire inside of our hearts to come this direction and say something here. Maybe not any different than what Brother Randy preaches, but just from a different angle or a different way that somebody will see it a little different than they've ever saw it before. And I want to do that tonight, and I want to do it with this verse. I want you to see a great man who had great potential that fell so miserably that it went down in the historical record of the Old Testament. Joab, he went out of this world without that glorious marching of the great warrior that he was. He found himself in an altar, holding to the horns of the altar, being slain. Not because he was so great, but because he was so little. I read to you in that 1 Kings chapter number 2 that this bloodthirsty man like Joab, if you wanted somebody to be on your side in a fight, you would want Joab. In fact, if you wanted somebody to carry out any kind of military action, you would want Joab, because his whole life was made up of fighting and killing. Sometimes he masqueraded it by being loyal to the king, or being loyal to this, or being loyal to that. But that's really not the case. There was something inside of Joab that was always just a little bit on the edge of doing what he wanted to do. Always a little bit of rebellion there. When David leaned back and said, "You go on into the battle, and you take care of things down there at the battle, but don't touch the boy. Don't touch the boy." I'm telling you, Joab is not the kind of man that you would want teaching the Sunday school class of your children. He kills the boys. He's not the kind of man that you would want to get to preach youth camps across the countryside, because you can't trust Joab with your children. Although he was a great man, and although he was a mighty warrior, you couldn't trust him to take orders. You couldn't trust him to have loyalty. You couldn't trust him to be able to override that inward temper and anger that must have been in him since childbirth. And the only way he could release it was with the sword. And there, according to this Bible, he didn't turn after Absalom. No, he didn't. In fact, Absalom never became a temptation to Joab, because at that moment of life, Joab was a conqueror. I mean, the ground that he was taken and the defense of the king that he was in charge of, it made him the go-to man. If you wanted to feel important in that kingdom, you just stay around Joab, because Joab had a feeling of self-importance. I can't fail. I can't do wrong. Even if I do wrong, the king doesn't have what it takes to rebuke me. Even if I kill his own son, I'm too big for that. The king doesn't know what to do with me. The king doesn't know how to control me. The king doesn't know how to corral me. Now, I don't want you jumping up, everybody, and clapping your hands together and shouting over the top of this message, because I'm going to tell you, there are people in our churches that have that same mentality. I don't care what I do, the king still isn't going to do anything with me. We all think that we're the exception to the rule, and everybody else is going to die lost and go to hell in adultery except me. Everybody else that's got a wicked mind and full of a pornographic heart is going to go to hell except me. I'm too important in the kingdom. I'm too important to the king. The king will bankrupt all of it in order to do something for me, because I'm special. But I'm going to tell you something right here and right now. We ain't ever so special that we can walk on the wishes of the king and turn our back on the wishes of the king, because it'll eventually come around to haunt us. Joab did not fall. He did not cave in when he was following after Absalom. He kept the right priorities. He kept the right things in his mind. He kept the right attitude in his mind. But I'm telling you, this is a story with a tragic ending. Because, brother, sister, and I'm going to be short. Because, brother, sister, I just read to you where he didn't cave in following Absalom. But he did turn when he was following Adonijah. You can go back and read the text again. In that particular text, David, I'm telling you, later in life, he seemed like all he could do was have trouble with his children. Of course, if you had had an illicit affair with a naked woman, somebody else's wife on another roof, and your baby dies, you're already heading for trouble. But when you have that kind of moral background, I can see why Absalom turned out to be a scoundrel. And I can see why Adonijah turned out to be a son that had a rebellious heart on the inside of him. Because, brother, sister, I mean this. Sometimes our children, down to the fourth generation, follow down the path that we've chosen for our very lives. And brother, I'm not standing here with fear or with favor to tell you that this man by the name of Joab was not an exception, and neither shall we be. Now listen, I want you to get this. This particular thing in David's life, and this particular uprising in David's life, was not as big as the uprising with Absalom. It was smaller. It wasn't as big a thing. This boy didn't have the same punch. He didn't have the same following. But this is my message. And you be careful. And you listen to me close. The caution is, not the big things in life that caused Joab to fail. He didn't follow after the big things that caused him to fail. But a little thing. A little unknown boy by the name of Adonijah got the great man to turn. There's probably not one person sitting in this church tonight that has a big screen, three-dimensional, 60-foot television sitting in the corner of your living room. Ain't going to fall for big things like that. But there are little subtle things out there in this world that causes men and women to turn from what's right. And the pitiful thing about it is, sometimes it's the smallest things that take the biggest men straight down to the bottom. We would think maybe, what, an alcoholic binge? A one night down at the bar? A one sleazy rendezvous with some streetwalker? We would think that it would take something big like that. But I'm telling you, according to this little verse, sometimes mighty people find themselves at the rock bottom because it was little things that they weren't paying attention to, that they didn't think was any big deal, that became the driving impulse and the driving influence in their life. There are preacher friends of mine who have morally destroyed their entire lives. They have morally bankrupted themselves in the very way and the very route that they have chosen. And I'm going to tell you something. If it had been an alcoholic binge, or if it had been, but I'm telling you, some of them, one of them I'm thinking about right now, one of them I'm thinking about lost his ministry over insecurity. I mean, he allowed insecurity to turn everybody against him, make everybody look like they hated him. And he drifted off of the scene with a bitter heart. Until this day, that bitterness can still be seen on the backside of his eyes. It wasn't a big thing that done it. It was just an Adonijah. It doesn't have to be a free-for-all. For you to get knocked out, you might just do it with a fever blister. Now listen, I'm not going to be up here all night. But that man that conquered one temptation after another, all down through life, came down to the very end of following the king that was now fixing to be taken right off of the scene. And some little lesser, smaller temptation grabbed such a hold of him that Joab lost that standing of being a mighty man of valor and a mighty man for God. And I don't have to stand up here and go down the list of 1,000 little things that will knock you out of the boat. But I'm telling you, evil thoughts, evil assumptions, little angers, little tempers, little things that we've harbored down inside of our heart. It wasn't a big Absalom. It was just the fact of a little thing that kept eating on you, and eating on you, and eating on you. Just a little thing. Little thing. Oh my God. Oh my God. When the challenge came to the life of Joab, I mean, when the challenge came, and Joab saw himself filleting under the power of some little known oppressor, something rose up in the king's heart that said, I can't ever trust him again. I can't ever trust him again. I want you to grab this close. In fact, he called his son Solomon into the room and said, son, not only can this generation never trust him, I can't trust him in your generation. You need to deal with Joab. And I mean, there are things that we have done in one generation that has been the destruction of the next generation. That's why you can't let little things become your God. I don't think that everybody that's in the organized churches, these assemblies of God, they were good to me and her. The preachers that used us back in the 70s and into the 80s were preachers that didn't agree with the Assemblies of God church and what they were doing then. The reason they called me and my wife, they wouldn't use any of their evangelists. They couldn't find any of them that met their criteria of being holiness. I don't think that everybody in Pentecostal holiness, I don't think everybody in the Pentecostal Church of God I don't think everybody in those groups have gone down the tubes and have lost that great glow of God. I'm telling you, there's still some old stalwarts. There's still some old timers that still stand up. A meeting I preached this year already from the back of the house, an old Assembly of God preacher walked up to me and he said, "We don't hear it no more. Like that, son, if I still had a church, I'd get you for a revival." I don't think they've all lost out. But I'm going to tell you something right now. When the Assemblies of God gave us the opportunity to join and be a state evangelist, and when the Pentecostal Holiness Church brought us into Tennessee and told us we could have the state of Tennessee if we'd just shine a little brighter and sign a little brighter and join the group, we recognized then that it's not always the big things that can get a hold of you. Sometimes it's the little things that you shouldn't get involved in. For instance, are you sure it's the will of God for you to have the job that you have? Are you sure it's the will of God? I'm just asking. Are you sure it's the will of God? Because if it takes you for days and days and weeks and months away from the spiritual leadership as husband of that household, or it takes you days and days away as a mama that's in charge with the keeping of the home and the raising of the children, sometimes it's little things that gets us before the big things ever do. Well, I want you to know something, hot shot. I keep the bills paid, and I keep a car in her garage, and I take care of the credit card. I'm thrilled about those big things. But what about the little things that get down inside of our heart and harbor in there until we lose it all? Now, I don't know if every one of you precious wives are convinced at this particular moment that you married the absolute perfect man of your dreams for your life. I'm going to drop a little pastoral word on you right here. Right or wrong, when you said I do, it became automatically, in the sight of God, a matrimony that could not be broken. You can't fall back on that 20 years and say, "I know I shouldn't have married when I did. He was out with one girl the night he asked me to get married." I'm telling you, sometimes it's little things that starts creeping up into the life of a wife. Unfulfilled. He doesn't love me as much as he loves his coonhound. He doesn't care about the children unless it's a ball game that he's taken the boys to. He's not even aware of the fact that our daughter's in band. He doesn't even know she plays a clarinet or a flute. And I'm telling you, little feelings start right. Am I having a hard time preaching this? Or am I preaching the right thing tonight? And tell you, it's these little things that starts welling up on the inside. You lose your love for him. You lose your trust for him. And the next thing that happens, you do become a nagging individual because you've lost respect and you're unhappy and you're doing everything you could possibly do to change it. But I'm telling you, drawing the sword, Joab, is not what's necessary to change it. Doing what the king said in the first place is what's necessary to have a happy home and a happy life. Sutures, give them a little more knockout gas. I got something else to tell them. These little things that well up on the inside. These young people with just a little bit of disgust and a whole lot of teenagerhood in them that walks out the door single-handedly, able to solve all the problems. I've always felt like we should vote in a 15-year-old to be president of the United States. Because they know more than anybody else they know more than their mom and dad does, and all you got to do is ask them. I think they'd be the perfect politician. I'm telling you, when a young person gets that attitude and don't sit there and look at me like I'm an old timer, I did not park my wheelchair outside yet. I'm telling you, just little things like that will breed such a contempt in the heart of a boy and a girl. It's been a long time. It's been a long time since I preached a funeral that had me so shook up that I could hardly control myself. When the police department first called and said, this family wants to have a memorial service here in West Plains for half of the baby. We told this family that it would be a safe place at your church, that you were our chaplain, and you could keep everything under control. Brother Barnett, they brought to Calvary Pentecostal Tabernacle a little urn with a little half of a two-year-old in it. And they set it on a little table up on our platform over by the organ. They lined it with her pictures. While they were setting this table up, I could recognize by the smoke and the flames coming out of the church parking lot that it was a rough family who didn't know anything about anything. I mean, they weren't even respectful enough to throw their cigarettes away from the front door. They just sat out there on the rails, and it was a terrible situation. I don't want everybody to get quiet. In this terrible situation, I walked to the back, picked up the telephone, and I said, there's another group of people with this family. And they said, yes, that's why we have an officer out in his patrol car sitting in your parking lot right now. And we suggest you put your Glock 19 underneath your arm. Wear your gun to the pulpit. Okay. I carry my sword to it every time I go. Just, well, take backup. Okay. So I marched out with this family, and there sat the other side of the family who had the other half of the baby up in another city in Missouri. But they were there in protest because this man, the daddies, live in slut, put the baby in a bathtub full of hot water and scalded the life out of her. I have half a child. I have two families. I have one side wanting revenge. I have another side wanting mercy. Oh, yeah. Little Twinkle Toes girlfriend, she will have a long, long time and lots of friends to retell this story to. But I'm telling you, it didn't change the fact that there's a two-year-old up here. And during that ceremony, during that time, I was so distraught. I mean, I was watching everybody's quick move and everybody's glances. And I had my wife, she had the little phone. She had all the numbers dialed into the police department except the last one. And they knew that if she rung that number to get that guy through that side door, right? I'm telling you, are you getting this? Are you getting this? You ain't getting this. After that little ceremony was over, and I walked up there and tried to lay my hands upon that boy who looked more like a sheepdog than he did anything else. He looked like a newspaper. He had enough ink on his body. He could have been a first edition in anybody's town. I raised my arm up there around him, and he said, you know, he said, I don't know who you are, but this is a far cry from my Sunday school days, ain't it? Are you getting this? I'm telling you, this man, what was it? Just a little girlfriend? A little breakup of a home? Just a little playing house? Now, I don't know, but I'm telling you. telling you these things have a way of crescendoing and getting so big and getting so big out of context that you lose everything. Everything. Streaming live over the internet, I'm even cautious about telling you other things that's coming to my mind. But I'm going to tell you this right now. If you are in this building and you are playing with a little fire, you're going to get a big blister. If you're in this building, and I said to myself today, while I was thinking about the service and pondering and wanting God to move in this service, and I said to myself, that's what I really need to preach on. I need to preach on God. I need to preach. I'm in my best element when I'm preaching about the power of God falling. But yet I also realized in my heart that revivals don't always stem from everybody jumping over the pew. Revivals begin when sinners see a need to put everything on the altar and get right with God. He did not follow after Absalom, but he did let Adonijah get him. And I'm not going to be long. I'm just going to tell you this. Would anybody in this room, right here in the quietness of this sanctuary, would anybody in this room like to wager a guess where he died? Would anybody like to look at the text? Read down through those words and let it dawn upon them where Joab met his gruesome end. Read it. He ran into the tabernacle. Ran down to the altar and wouldn't turn loose of the altar because it was his contact with what was spiritual, but he wouldn't repent, which is your contact with God. And he died holding on to a tradition. He died holding on. Where were they at? They went to church, yeah. Yeah, not just before it happened. They was in church. They was down there at that altar. What were they doing? Well, it looked to me like they was holding on. Ain't good enough. Ain't good enough. Ain't good enough. Well, I heard, oh boy, what happened just before he left her? Well, he went to church. He's in that Randy West meeting down there. Whoever that guy was from Missouri is up there hollering and screaming. All everybody could think about on Wednesday night was a hot dog. They couldn't only get their mind on church. Him up there talking about mosquitoes and funerals and 1,000 other things. And it was the last night the guy was in the church. And the next thing you know, he's on the headlines of the local newspaper. I'm telling you, just being in somebody's church and getting down in somebody's altar doesn't mean you're not following after something that's gonna get you. Brother Randy, Brother Barnett, Brother Ronnie, I have preached in years past, don't everybody's mind start trying to get like a calculator. Don't go down the list of has-beens and greats. Just listen to me. I have preached in churches and been in meetings and been in other activities where before I ever had a chance to say one word, guys, I didn't have a chance to talk to my wife, not one word. I've had my wife sometimes walk into our trailer and close the door and tell me, I don't feel right around that guy. Don't be gone and leave me here to answer the door where this guy's at. At the end of a camp meeting one night, visited out there in the trailer by an individual. At the end of the visit, the door was shut. My wife looked at me and she said, "Don't ever leave me alone in the trailer with that guy. Somebody, right? Somebody." And I'm telling you, you know, here I am, snot-nosed evangelist coming out of Karnak. Dad was a postmaster. Mom worked for the state of Illinois. I wasn't as in tune as that preacher's daughter that was raised in the house of God and had watched from an early age all the way to adulthood and marrying this preacher. Are you getting this? And all I could see, Brother Barnett, was the guy was doing the speaking. And the guy was up front. All I could see is how everybody was applauding everything that was done. But in the back of my mind, don't ever leave me alone with him. Something ain't right. Don't ever. And you know something? You know something, Brother Randy? Man, I'm so out in left field that somebody's going to have to throw the ball back into home plate. I can't get her there. But you know something? It wasn't a big thing that crumbled the empire. It was just a little something. And I confronted my friend about it. And I talked to him about it with tears and with sympathy. But he let it grow and let it grow and let it grow. He is not a stranger to a church. He is not a stranger to the altar. But he's a stranger to David. He doesn't know the King. He doesn't know the King. He's a stranger to Solomon. He doesn't know the King's kid. And how in the name of God's heaven, with revival, last night people shout, how do young people marry out of the faith when they are raised in churches that have the moving of the Holy Ghost? I'll tell you how they do it. It starts with a little thing. I had an issue in this United States of America that involved cell phones, computer pictures, and individuals sending nude, obscene photographs to each other. Cell phone. It's just a little thing. I mean, it ain't no Playboy magazine here. We're not talking about going out renting an RA movie. It's amazing to me how the big things we steer clear of. But it's the little things that are going to kill us. Right down in the front of the church. Right down in the altar. Because we're going to plead this. This is what we're going to plead. Lord, haven't I done some... Hey, get that folder that my wife keeps about camp meetings and camp meeting flyers. Look at that deal she put on for me back 30 when I was in this ministry 30 years, 6 years ago. Look at that thing she done. Haven't I cast out? And sometimes something as little as a message on a phone that should have never been sent. My God. You know, I always used to worry about the rat in the middle of town until the mouse in the house became one of the most damaging little things that men and women and teenagers can put their hands on and push the screen wherever they want it to go. Boy, it's quiet. I'm telling you, Brother Webb, I felt good last night, and I was jumping up and down Monday night, and I was enjoying the glory of God Sunday night. But I'm ringing somebody's doorbell tonight. I am ringing somebody's doorbell tonight. And before we can have that move of Pentecost that I wanted to preach about tonight. Before we could have the love of my life and that outpouring of the Spirit of God that I wanted to lay out here so thick that we'd wade through deep waters trying to get home. We got folks in here tonight. They're not in a condition to get the baptism of the Holy Ghost. You're not in a condition to throw yourself in God's mercy. Because little things in our lives, little things. Now, Father, I'm going to quit right here. I'm going to quit right here lest individuals in this room start trying to put a name and figure out a problem with anybody or everybody who responds to this altar call that I'm fixing to make. In no form or fashion do I pretend to have the light on anything that I said tonight other than I felt you leading me. I tossed it down no row. I left it in no man's lap on purpose. I simply stepped behind this pulpit without conversation with Brother Randy, without pulling aside any of the men of his board or asking anybody about anything about who might, who could, and who would. I stand here tonight with a guilt-free conscience that even though I may not have had a very good sermon, I came up here tonight with a very potent message. Sweetheart, I think we could have the beatenest sermon you've ever seen in your life if we could have enough of the convicting power of God to fall down into this building to start making the altar call for me, because it's not within my power to pull you out of that seat. It's got to be God. And I pray that there's nobody sitting in this house tonight that's gone so far that you don't even feel the slightest tug of the Lord telling you, He's right, you know He's right. He's right, you know He's right. You've gone so far and you've got past that so far that you can come down to the altar in a blazing turn of righteous holiness and know within your heart when you kneel, little things, little things, little things, little things. And so while my wife starts to play something, most time I don't hardly have a lick of music during an altar call. Most times I don't. Most times it distracts me, and I figure it might distract you. But on the little note that there may need to be enough of the minstrel's music to drive the evil spirits away long enough for the Lord to deal with your heart again, I feel like a husband and a wife should take each other by the hand, step out into an aisle, walk down this aisle together, kneel around this altar, and not get up until you know that the little things have been taken care of, and now it's joy unspeakable and full of glory. I'm not going to wince at the fact if some boy gets up and comes down here alone. And I'm not going to bemoan the fact if some dear lady in this congregation whose companion used to come with her and won't even come with her no more to church, if she feels like she needs to come down to this altar and bare her heart and check out her heart and make sure the little things that tripped him up doesn't do the same for her. I'll not wince if it's a teenage boy or girl. But I am overwhelmed, overwhelmed, overwhelmed by the sensation that a husband and wife, hand in hand, could step out into an aisle and come down to this altar and break open the door that leads to the staircase that Brother Barnett was preaching about. And there'll be a glorious time of angels ascending and descending tonight in this service. And we can get everything, including the little things, took care of.